This is Rabbi Jeff Sachs, that's it in the Web Yeshiva, with our series on Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik's Halachic Man. Examining the Halachic Man's approach to reality, to the world in which we, the universe, the created universe, the cosmos which we occupy. Previously, he had outlined his supporting characters, the homo religiosus and the cognitive man, how each of them undertakes this. In the last number of weeks, I've used this table. Where is it? It should be around here. Nope. There you go. This table to explain how each of the characters relates to or rejects or accommodates the world of the material world, reality, and the spiritual world, the transcendent realm. If you can't fill this chart out now by yourself, so then you should go back and review a little bit. But I'm not gonna do that. I'm not gonna do that again at this point. And we're in the middle of this very very descriptive, very evocative, poetic, perhaps the most well-known passage in the work, where the Rav describes how halachic man approaches reality, that there's no phenomenon, there's no real phenomenon, there's nothing we encounter in the world, in the natural world, to which halachic man does not possess a fixed relationship from the outset and a clear, definitive, a priori orientation. Before he encounters it, he already knows it. And last week I used a number of metaphors to try to explain this. What the blueprint is to the architect in terms of orienting himself to the created structure, what the musical notations are to the composer in order relative to the actual played symphony, the halacha, with a capital H broadly defined, is for halachic man the lens through which he interprets reality. And there were these very evocative descriptions of encountering a bubbling stream or the sunset, and then in a kind of parenthetical aside, I described how the Rav himself epitomized this when trying to make sense of not phenomena in the natural, physical, created world, but trends and politics and historical events, that these two can be interpreted and must be interpreted through the halachic prism. And that the halachic prism is the radar by which we interpret reality. But the map is laid out before we've ever got there. In other words, as opposed to a map, a road map. When we were in school, I wonder how it's done today. The kids even learn how to read maps. I remember when I was in school, in elementary school, a number of curricular units were given over to maps and globes and map reading. I even remember a fourth grade teacher trying to show us the proper way to fold a map. Remember those maps that you used to get in the gas station? They'd sit in the glove compartment. I'm going to come back to this momentarily because we're going to talk about contemporary GPS, how early map makers could portray on a flat two-dimensional surface something which is, after all, three-dimensional. The difference between a projection map and a Mercator map and different ways of representing reality, both of which are imperfect, because you're trying to paint a picture of something that can't be depicted in that medium, at least not fully, and therefore you're going to get all these distortions, and that's why Greenland always looks so colossally big, much bigger than it looks like when you actually look on a globe, which is a much more accurate representation one-to-one of what everything looks like. So halachic man is interested in sociological creations, the state, society, the relationship of individuals with communal context. This is, I previewed these topics at the end of last week. The halacha encompasses laws of business, torts, neighbors, plaintiffs, defendants, creditor, debtor, partners, agents, workers, artisans, baileys, etc., what we talked about as what we talk about as choshen mishpat, financial law, family life, even ha'ezer, marriage, divorce, chalit sasota, conjugal refusal, respective rights, obligations, duties of a husband and wife. And again, he's just cataloging the spectrum of topics that the halakha concerns itself with. The halakha is involved with psychological problems, for example, sanity and insanity, the possibility or impossibility of a happy marriage, migo, and these are for halachic purposes. He's interested in psychology, not qua psychology, but he's interested in psychology for the purposes of making halachic determinations. If someone is insane when they enter a contract, if someone is insane when they enter a marriage, is the marriage, is the contract binding? That's a halachic question. The measure, therefore, is longer than the earth and broader than the sea. Arukami eretz mida, this pasuk the Rav uses a few times from Sefer Iyov, to describe the scope of the halachic interest, broader than the sea, broader than the earth, longer than the earth, broader than the sea. There's no, literally no topic which the halakha is not interested in. The halakha has affixed a priori relationship to the whole of reality in all of its fine and detailed particulars. Again, a priori from the outset, right, before we encounter the spring, before the halakhic man ever ventures out into nature, right, he has already a fixed relationship, he has a concept that he then superimposes upon this natural phenomena that he sees. All halakhic concepts are a priori, and it is through them that the halachic man looks at the world. Here we have a notion that, underlying, between the lines here is the notion, principally a Kabbalistic notion. That God looked into the Torah. The Torah itself is a form of blueprint for creation, without getting involved in the depths of it right now. But that somehow these halachic concepts in a kind of ideal pre-existed, were conceived before creation, were conceived by God before creation. Above all, the world, his worldview, halachic man's worldview, is similar to that of the mathematician, a priori and ideal. Both the mathematician and the halachist gaze at the concrete world from an a priori ideal standpoint, and use a priori categories and concepts which determine from the outset their relationship to the qualitative phenomena they encounter. Both examine empirical reality from the vantage point of an ideal reality. There's one question from which they raise. Does this real phenomena correspond to their ideal construction? In other words, you postulate, you theorize, the mathematician postulates, theorizes. There are rules of mathematics. There are rules of geometry. There are rules of how space works. There are rules of physics, and we can speculate on how that should be, and then we test it. I'm going to come back to this at the end of the chapter, but just today or yesterday, there was this big news in the world of physics about proving some theory about the Big Bang. In other words, here's a theory. It stood around for about 30 years, but in the absence of any way to test it, it was merely a theory. That's an a priori theory about how the world works. And only now has science caught up, or the technologies caught up, to allow us to experiment and to make conclusive proof one way or the other. And then when they do the experiment, they look to see, does the theory and the practice, the theory and the reality, correspond? The question is, in science and mathematics, the presumption is that the theory will fall away, the hypothesis will fall away, if it doesn't correspond to reality. We'll have to see how that plays out in halakha. When many halakhic concepts do not correspond to the phenomena of the real world, halakhic man is not at all distressed. This doesn't cause a problem for him. his deepest desire is not the realization of the halakha, but rather the ideal construction which was given to him from Sinai. And this ideal construction exists forever. Now there's going to be a long discourse about the difference between what we call halakha and halakha lama'aseh. Halakha lama'aseh, or in the conventional parlance, halakha lama'aseh, is practical halakha. If you have a particular question about can you use this kind of carrot peeler on Shabbat, and you go to your rabbi, usually you want a kind of yes or no question. And there's the yes or no answer. And there's no shortage of books and handbooks and guidebooks and halachic works that will analyze the status of your carrot peeler on Shabbat and its permitted or forbidden use. That's halacha lama'aseh, normative practical halacha. You need to know today is Tuesday, coming up in a few days it's going to be Shabbos again, there's going to be a carrot that needs peeling, can you or can't you? Halacha, let's say again with a capital H, is the theory, is the principle, is the almost abstract ideas that stand behind what comes out the other end of the, pardon me for the crass metaphor, the other end of the sausage maker to arrive at a definitive yes or no answer. Halachic man is not always concerned with the halacha lama'aseh, which is not to say that halachic man doesn't know the halacha lama'aseh, the practical yes or no question, if I forgot Yalav Yavo, do I have to repeat the Shemona Esrei? It doesn't mean that when he's, you know, sitting in the synagogue and someone approaches him with a question, he's unable to give a definitive ruling. But what he, as this kind of idealized type, is interested in is the realm of the abstract halakha. Someone described it once as the difference between a legal scholar and a judge. A legal scholar, a professor, a tenured professor of law at Yale or Harvard, can examine matters in the law and do it in the abstract. A judge or a justice sitting on a court has to issue a psak halacha, quote unquote. He has to determine, is the person in front of him guilty or not? Is he obligated to pay damages? Did he break the law? Is there a constitution? Was the constitution upheld or abrogated, et cetera, et cetera? And this will lead them into different areas of analysis, and this will lead them into, this is, in America, this is always a question of, you know, who are the best, where do the best jurists come from? More recently, Supreme Court justices have been chosen from the realm of academia. But once upon a time, that wasn't the case. They came from the realm of politics. They had been legislators. They had been people that were involved in lawmaking in different ways. They'd been governors or other such things. And it's going to affect how you approach the question. There's an ironic flip side that I know many people, I know many fellow rabbis, that when they need to ask a kind of thorny question to a rabbi greater than them, they're presented with a question by one of their congregants, and they don't feel qualified to take it on their shoulders alone. Well, there are two types of rabbis you can pick up the phone and call. You can call a someone who is a master of the entire scope of the halakha, but has spent his whole life in the Beit Midrash, and you can call someone who's presumably similarly a master of the halakha, but has had practical experience in the rabbinate, interacting with congregants. And that may lead each of them to different conclusions. Not that one is right and one is wrong, but we're aware that within the realm of halacha, it's not always clear that there's one definitive only answer to a particular question, particularly if it's rather complex. And this will lead people in different directions. The halachic man, and again, I remind you, we're talking about these ideal abstract types, these typological characters. The halachic man is the law professor. The halachic man is the person who spent his career inside the Beit Midrash. It's told that, you know, some of these actual halachic men would shy away from actual halachic ruling. In Brisk, for example, where Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, the Rav's grandfather, who we'll talk about momentarily, was the rabbi, there was someone else who was the kind of a posek. I mean, if there were major issues related to communal policy, obviously Rav Chaim was involved. But for day-to-day psak and day-to-day shilas, there was someone else you could turn to for answers. Because Rav Chaim had like a little allergy to being involved at that practical level. It's said that, you know, when you can see all sides of one issue, that sometimes makes it difficult to come down with a one-sided ruling, which is, after all, what the shoel needs. You need to know, can I or can't I eat this chicken? Can I or can't I peel this carrot? So the idea of a kind of abstract halakha that only exists in theory but not in practice does not bother halachic men. And then he mentions these ideas that the Gemara talks about, that there are halachot which are not practical, meaning they're not in practice. Not, for example, the halachot of the Beit HaMikdash. There's so many mitzvot that we can't do because we are in a historical period in the absence of the Beit HaMikdash. But perhaps there are halachot, the Gemara speculates, that were never practiced. They were only, you know, kind of ideas on the books, but that they never actually had an actual implementation in the real world. The case of the Ir HaNidacha, the case of the Ben Sorer Umore, two rather radical cases where under certain circumstances an idolatrous city would have to be completely destroyed, or a rebellious son would have to be executed in order to prevent him from future and further sin. The Gemara speculates that the halakha created a scenario by which there are so many different mitigating circumstances that for this halakha to actually, these halakhot to actually have been implemented, it could almost never happen. So if that's the case, then why have it on the books at all? Why have it on the books at all? Expound it and receive a reward. It's only there merely as a matter of study, as a non-implementable ideal, something which doesn't correspond to the world in which we live, even though it's technically on the books. And this is not a problem halachic man is not at all distressed. Halachic man is not at all grieved by the fact that many ideal constructions have never been and will never be actualized. What difference does it make whether the idolatrous city, the leprous house, the rebellious son existed or didn't exist in the past, will exist or won't exist in the future? Yesod HaYesodot, then the pillar of halachic thought, is not the practical ruling, the halacha lemaaseh, but the determination of the theoretical halacha. Therefore, many of the greatest halachic men avoided and still avoid serving in rabbinical posts where you're presented with actual practical halachic questions. They rather join themselves to the group of those who are reluctant to render practical decisions, and if necessary, which is not to be decried, compels them to disregard their preference and to render practical decisions. This is only a small and significant responsibility which does not stand at the center of their concerns. Yeah, so, and it's correct, and just having it on the books is there in the realm of values. It's communicating something about, you know, what we believe and who we are, even if we don't actually implement it, because its implementation would be too terrible. Another example, although not exactly formulated in the same way by the Gemara, is the death penalty. You're aware that the Torah allows for the death penalty for all types of cases. But the Chazal created a circumstance in which the actual implementation of the death penalty, the bar was set so high that for someone to actually be liable to the death penalty in a Jewish court, you had to have this constellation of circumstances all aligning in the right way, with the witnesses and the kinds of witnesses and the kinds of warning and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that it was almost impractical. And the Gemara suggests that if the death penalty was actually carried out once every 70 years, it's too much, or it's an exaggeration, or that would be an indication that the system had gone awry. It's too much. So then, if that's the case, why is there a death penalty? Well, the death penalty there is to express the severity of certain sins. You know, not all sins are created alike. And the severity of sins that carry the death penalty are obviously a kind of way of putting a kind of valuative price tag on it to say this is something that's very that's extremely severe. This is something that we really want to root out from our world and from our society. We don't carry out the death penalty because of the without going into contemporary politics about the death penalty in the United States today. But we're aware that it's the consequences of getting it wrong outweigh the value of having it on the books, or the value of having it as a practical solution. The theoretical halakha, not the practical decision, the ideal creation, not the empirical one, represent the longing of halachic man. Halachic man engages in theoretical discussion and debate concerning the subjects of sacrifices and purity and plumbs the depth of those concepts, laws, distinctions, the same seriousness that he investigates and searches out the laws of aguna, plaintiff and defendant, the forbidden foods, which are all, of course, practical laws. In other words, an aguna, an abandoned woman, a woman who's again, literally chained to her, or figuratively, chained to her husband, in a way that she can't initiate or receive a divorce. This is a very practical question. Forbidden foods, this chicken, can I or can't I eat it? Shimon and Levi come before you, and one claims that the other one owes him money, and the second one denies it. Well, you need to come up with a decision. These are all practical. These are all practical issues that have to be ruled. But the halachic man is just as concerned with the abstract halachot, the halachot which are either not currently implementable because of the absence, principally because of the absence of the temple or because of the absence of the whole system of ritual purity and impurity or any other number of things that would render a halakha not contemporarily practical, or not practical because it was never a practical halakha, but it's merely something that's there on the books. The yeshiva in Volozhin. Now, we have to pause and say something about the yeshiva in Volozhin. Where is it? There's the yeshiva in Volozhin. The Volozhin yeshiva, which was called the mother of all yeshivot, the yeshiva in Volozhin was founded and the building was built in the first decade of the 19th century in this little town of Volozhin, which was then part of Jewish Lithuania. It's today part of Belarus. It's in the country of Belarus. There's the building. It doesn't it look remarkably small? This was the mother of all yeshivot. Apparently there were some other like outlying buildings, but now we think about yeshivot, and the buildings that they occupy. This was, really quite a modest. The building is still there. If you Google it, you can find the contemporary pictures of the building. The building, the Yeshiva Volozhin, was founded by Reb Chaim Volozhiner, not to be confused with Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, who we're going to talk about momentarily. Reb Chaim Volozhiner was a student of the Vilna Gaon. If we had more time, we would spend more time talking about the Vilna Gaon. If you're unfamiliar with who the Gaon of Vilna, or the Gura, as he is known, Rabbi Eliyahu, the Gaon of Vilna, so a quick trip to Wikipedia will fill you in on the pertinent details. And among the very many innovations of the Yeshiva Volozhin that made it such an influential yeshiva and became the kind of a bedrock of Eastern European or Lithuanian style Jewish learning, which in many ways is predominant until today, was a notion, a curricular reform. The Yeshiva of Volozhin introduced the study of the entire Talmud from beginning to end, from Brachot to Nida. That's the first and last Masechtot Mishas. It's like saying from A to Z. Previously, only select Masechtot, the previous practice of skipping over those tractates which do not deal with the laws that are practiced nowadays. You know, there are certain Masechtot that are practical, that have contemporary relevance for halacha lemaaseh. Every Masechta, in some way, has some practical application, but some more and some less. So Masechet Shabbat, for example, is obviously practical. Masechet Bava Metzia, which deals with financial laws, is obviously practical. But Zvachim, Menachot, things that deal with sacrifices in the temple, this wasn't studied because it wasn't something that, unfortunately, anyone had to occupy themselves with. And I guess the Jewish learners and teachers figured that Mashiach will come, we'll rebuild the Beit HaMikdash, and then we'll turn our attention to those things. Large sections of Masechet Sanhedrin that deal with the Jewish courts, the Sanhedrin, the High Court, the implementation of those penalties and death penalties, which were not practical all the years we were under the thumb of Gentile authorities in the diaspora. These were simply not studied. Reb Chaim Soloveitchik was subsequently one of the Rosh Yeshiva in Volozhin, among the last generation of Yeshiva in Volozhin. There's Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, meaning that's the Rav's grandfather. The Rav, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, had a father named Moshe Soloveitchik, who had a father named Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, also known by the acronym the Grach, Gon Rabbeinu Chaim. He died in 1918. He was the founder of this analytical school of Talmud study called Brisk, or Brisker Lumdus, named after the town in which he was the rabbi, the town of Brisk in Lithuania. And for a period of time, he served as a teacher and as Rosh Hashiva in Volozhin. Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, aside from his regular lectures at Yeshiva Volozhin, would also deliver a parallel shiurim on the Zvachim, about the animal offerings, Menachot, the meal offerings in the temple, things which were, it was just simply not studied. When he would deliver a lecture on Eruvin, you know, the laws having to do with Shabbat boundaries and carrying in the public domain on Shabbat, he also dealt with the Mishnaic treatise of Ohalot. These are parallel concepts. One has a practical implication, and one is not contemporary practical because it deals with the Masechta of Ohalot, of tents, deals with Tumah and Tahara, purity, ritual purity and impurity, and being in contact or under the same structure as a dead body or other forms of ritual impurity. That's not practical today because we don't practice those laws in the absence of the Parah Aduma, the Red Heifer, and the absence of the Beit HaMikdash. But since there are these kind of conceptual parallels between the two cases, one halacha lamaaseh and one merely theoretical halacha, the Chaim would study them together. When he would study Masechet Brachot, he would also deal with the agricultural laws, Truma, Maaseh, and all those things which were certainly not practical in, even though they are contemporarily practical in the land of Israel, in Lithuania, they certainly were not. A significant part of the halachic novella is devoted to laws of sacrifice and purity and defilement. Where am I? And then similarly, the Netziv for Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, there's the Netziv, who was also a Rosh Hashiva in Belozhin. He died in 1893. The Netziv is an acronym for his name, Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. The Netziv acted in a similar fashion as did many Torah giants, both before and after them. This stance has been a fundamental characteristic of halachists from time immemorial. In this footnote 27, the Rav Kleiner gives you a long catalog. It runs for almost a page of different books, different sefarim that were written by Rabbonim over the years that are given over exclusively to halachic analysis of non-practical halachot, of things which are only theoretically practical, which are only theoretical today because they are not currently in effect because of historical exigencies. Then he goes on in this long passage where he says, it wasn't just Reb Chaim and those figures at the end of the 19th century. It is curious. It is interesting. It is an interesting question, and some people have written on the question of Brisker Lundis, which comes around at the end of the 19th century, this kind of like wave, this transition in how Talmud is studied. This component of looking at the entire corpus of the Talmud and not only those practical matters, those practical sections. That's only one component of Brisker Lundis. What brought it about? Like, what set the stage that it became so popular? That for many centuries, Talmud was studied according to one fashion, and then there's this sea shift in how Gemara is studied, which to a very real degree is still the dominant practice today. I'm going to leave that as a side question, but it's an interesting one. There's all types of speculation as to what did that, or looking at parallel trends in general society, speculating about how those other trends in general society may have impacted on the Jewish trends. It's an interesting question in the history of ideas. I'm not going to address it now, but I'm just drawing it to your attention. A few years ago, I wrote a short piece. I'll post it, which is a translation of a different thing the Rav wrote, where he's describing the characteristics of Brisker Lundis. And it's a very interesting and important parallel piece to Halachic Man. I'll post the link to that. You'll get it with the sources for next week. He points out that the Rambam in the Mishneh Torah, in the Yad HaChazakah, when the Rambam wrote the first real encyclopedia of Halacha, and points out that what I'm describing is exclusively descriptive of Eastern European Ashkenazi yeshiva study, not the Sephardic traditions, which at this time in the 19th century were, even in the late 19th century, were in places like Morocco and still in Iraq and still in Yemen and these other places where there were still active Jewish communities up until, even up until the 1950s, when those communities largely were emptied out. Assyria, of course, those communities were largely emptied out and came to the land of Israel. And the Sephardic tradition of Talmud study differs in many important ways, but that's a different topic, of course. So when the Rambam sets out to write the Yad HaChazakah, he makes a very interesting decision. Instead of writing the first kind of code of halacha, because remember, the Gemara is not exactly a code of halacha, although it's the raw material from which any code of halacha is devised. But if you need to look up a practical question to a practical answer to a practical question, you'd be lost trying to look for the Gemara. It's not the Shulchan Aruch. It's not the Shmirat Shabbat Kehilchata. So when the Rambam sets out to write the Mishneh Torah, he could have written a book that dealt only with the practical halacha. but he doesn't. He writes an entire encyclopedia of halakha, almost as if we're still living in the times of the Beit HaMikdash. And the Rav describes, he gives a few different examples, principally from Yom Kippur, but also we're coming up on Pesach. If you look here, I've skipped ahead now to the middle of page 26. When Maimonides describes the order, the Seder of the 15th of Nisan, what we call Leil HaSeder, he quote unquote forgets temporarily that he is living approximately 1,000 years after the destruction of the temple. And he paints the image of the service of this holy festival night in a wealth of colors that dazzle the eye. He describes the laws of the Seder night as if we still had the Korban Pesach, as if we still had the sacrifice which served as the kind of centerpiece of the Seder meal. The whole Seder meal is built around, I mean, we are almost too much oblivious to this today, that the Seder, which, you know, we all, you know, the moment after the Purim Suda, everybody starts getting tense about Pesach and starting to clean and starting to get ready, and where's the Seder going to be this year, and how are we going to involve the children, and, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we build up to this, you know, to this magnificent night, but we're sometimes unaware that, like, we the centerpiece of it is kind of missing. And the centerpiece of the Seder was the eating of the Korban Pesach, the Passover sacrifice, which we don't have anymore, of course. When you read what to do, if you read the Rambam's Mishneh Torah, his laws of Passover, he almost, as it were, forgets that we're living in a time where these things don't apply. And then, almost parenthetically, he tells you, oh yeah, by the way, nowadays, this is what we do. But he writes the halakha in its ideal format. Interestingly, 300 years later, more, 350 years later, when Shulchan Aruch is written, the Shulchan Aruch makes a different decision. And he writes a halakhic code which really is only focused on the halakha l'maaseh. You can't look in the Shulchan Aruch for the laws of the Korban Pesach. You can't look in the Shulchan Aruch for the laws of Tumah v'Tahara. He knew that he was living in a time. He doesn't create this kind of mental illusion that we're living in the ideal time. We're living in an ideal historical period. The Seder with which Maimonides, I've skipped ahead to the bottom of page 27, the Seder with which Maimonides is dealing is an ideal conception of the Passover night. Our great master pays no attention to the cruel and bitter present in which we are only play-acting, because we don't have the full array of mitzvot. The picture of the restored Jerusalem, the temple in all its splendor, the priests at their service, the Israelites performing the commandments of the night hovers before his eyes, however. From time to time, he bestirs himself from his ideal dream and romantic vision and finds himself confronted with the exile filled with nightmares and terrors, the physical oppression and spiritual denigration. And then he states, Malasot, in the present time, so the person at the Seder does not say, tonight is all this, etc., etc. In other words, again, skipping ahead here, in other words, the present time, the historical period in which he was living and which we're still living, in other words, the present time is only a historical anomaly in the ongoing process of the actualization of the ideal halakha in the real world. And there is no need to elaborate about a period which is but a temporary aberration that has seized hold of our historical existence, even though it's now been going on for 2,000 years. But this 2,000-year pause that we've been in is a mere aberration. The halakha remains in full force. What's the halakha about this? Somebody goes up to the rabbi and says, "Rabbi, you know, after shul, people go up to the rabbi. One guy asks about the parrot healer, and another guy asks about Yalav Yavo, and a third guy asks about the Korban Pesach." So the rabbi's going to say, "What are you talking about? We don't have the Korban Pesach." So it doesn't matter. For the halachic man, it doesn't matter. The halachic man would answer all questions the same. As a matter of fact, if those three guys went to the halachic man, only the one asking about the Korban Pesach might walk away with a satisfactory answer. And the other two might, in some ways, be more confused because they would have gotten an entire discourse on the lumdus, the theoretical halakha behind carrot peeling and yalav yavo saying. The halakha remains in full force. The halakha of Korban Pesach. Even though, what can we do? We can't do it. I mean, at least last year we couldn't. We still have a month. But in the event that we can't do it this year again, it doesn't mean that there's no such thing as Korban Pesach. There is. We couldn't pull it off this year. The halakha remains in full force, and we hope for and eagerly await the day of Israel's redemption when the ideal world would triumph over the profane reality. And when a halachic man stands up and prays, "May it be your will," this is on Kiddush Levana, which I mentioned last week or the week before. When we say in the Kiddush Levana that we ask that God will replenish the deficiency of the moon and it will no longer be diminished, he refers to the replenishment of the deficiency of the real cosmos, which does not correspond to the ideal image of reality. In other words, there's this idea, again, I mentioned this in passing, I think 2 weeks ago, this idea that in the original plan of creation, the sun and the moon were meant to be co-equals, and we all know the famous Rashi, towards the beginning of Bereshit, that the moon complained and his size was reduced, and etc. So when we say we want to go back to the original plan, we want to go back to the original plan. We want the reality to meet the blueprint. You know, like if anybody ever designed a house, I mean, we did. This is true for many people in Israel. Many people who buy a home in Israel, they buy new construction. There are all types of financial incentives for that. So, you know, you see the house on paper, and then you pay for it, and then they go and they build it, and it's not ready on time. And then when it's ready, you go to the house, and it doesn't exactly look like it looked like on paper. Because on paper, they have those little sketches where they show like where you might put your couch and where you might put your furniture and your kitchen table and your living room, your bookcases and things like that. And somehow, on the sketch, they must be working with like dollhouse furniture, because on the sketch you can fit in many more things. So if you have a couch which is about 1 foot by 3 foot, 3 feet, you're going to have a lot more space in your living room. But if you have actual furniture like actual real people have, you're going to be stuck trying to figure out how it's all going to fit in. And it's true that we knew what the measurements of the house were, and I guess we could have gone out, to like an open lot and put chalk on the ground and measured it out, to see exactly how big it is. But until you actually see it, I don't know anybody that built a house and said, "Gee, it's a lot bigger than I thought it was going to be. We can fit in more furniture than we anticipated. I'm going to have no problem, finding room for all my books." Usually it's the exact opposite. So you have the blueprint, and then you have the reality, and it doesn't match up. So when we pray in the Kiddush Levana that we want to go back to the blueprint of creation, which doesn't correspond to the world as it is now. Halachic, so it's a question, what does that mean? What does it actually mean that the moon would have been co-equal to the sun? And questions what the world would be like if we actually had, light all 24/7. So who knows what that means? But it somehow means that it was a world without, at least as interpreted midrashically, maybe it means that it was a world without rivalry. And the first rivalry in creation, before Cain and Hevel, I mean, if you only read the Chumash, the first rivalry, the first strife is Cain and Hevel. Whatever's happening between Adam and Eve and the Nachash, you can also count that up. But at least on a Midrashic level, the first rivalry is the sun and the moon. So maybe it was a plan for creation without division. Maybe it was a plan for creation without divergent camps, without rivalry, without tension, without machloket, without who knows, you know, what it actually means. But when we pray to go back to the original plan of creation, that's what we're talking about. I wanted to mention an example from earlier when we talk about the halachic man is not disturbed by the fact that, you know, sometimes the building doesn't match the blueprint. So, and we started talking about maps before. So to go back to the example of the maps, so nowadays kids don't know about maps because of the GPS, because everybody has Google Maps on their phone. So, you know, it's a little better than it used to be. But remember when Google Maps first came out or the GPSs first came out, and you'd be driving around and it would say, there were all these, if you like, look on YouTube, you can find these kind of satire videos where, like, you know, if you follow the GPS directions, you're actually going to, like, drive right into a lake. Because the map and the reality did not match up. And that would, you know, sometimes cause you to go actually, like, you know, driving right off the cliff. You can't rely only on the map. You can't rely only on the directions of the GPS, because if it doesn't correspond with what you're looking at, you're stuck. Like somebody that caused like a terrible accident because they were, you know, the GPS like sent them down a one-way street. You know, you would not be able to claim in a court of law, I listened to the GPS. That would not really be a mitigating circumstance. You're responsible to actually follow the reality. The GPS or the map is only meant to be used as an aid, but it's not the final determiner. The halakha is the opposite. The halakha is the opposite. If the reality doesn't match up to the halakhic GPS, that's not a problem for the halakhic man. The halachic GPS, the halachic ideal, still remains pure, even though for some reason it doesn't match up with reality at the moment. Halachic man's ideal, I'm skipping ahead to the top of page 29. Halachic man's ideal is to subject reality to the yoke of the halacha. However, as long as this desire cannot be implemented, halachic man does not despair. So what? 2,000 years we can't do the halachot that are not in practice today. That's not a problem. I mean, we'd like to change it. We'd like to restore the practice of being in control of our own lives and our own destinies. But this kind of temporary pause that we've been on for oh so long, it's not a problem. Halachic man does not despair, nor does he reflect at all concerning the clash of the real and the ideal, the opposition which exists between the theoretical halacha and the actual deed, between law and life. He goes his own way and does not kick against his law and fate. I read that, you know, there are all these, you know, deposed kingdoms throughout Europe, the Kaiser in Germany, the Tsar in Russia, etc. So, I mean, forgetting whether or not Anastasia survived the Romanov massacre, but you know, all of these deposed kingdoms that, you know, went out of business in Europe, there are still descendants of those, of whoever the last king of the last Kaiser of Germany, or the last Kaiser of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the last Tsar of Russia, and on paper. You can Google it and find it. On paper, you can find, you know, who Lu Yitzur, the Russian Revolution had not succeeded. Who would be the guy that today would be the Tsar of Russia? So he's a businessman. He probably has more money than you and me. But But he's, you know, he's got to, you know, these guys, they have to get up and go to work. And the fact that they have this yichus going all the way back, you know, at this point now, almost 100 years, you know, is merely a theoretical thing. And there are still people that long for the restoration of the Russian Tsar. And you can understand why people, you know, would think that anything would be better than Putin these days. But there are people that all, so what does it mean that he, that this guy, like, the halakha is that he's really the Tsar of Russia. But it's got no practical, it's got no practical meaning. He's got no power, he's got no authority, he's got no riches, he's got no even moral authority. He exercises no leadership ability. But in some kind of theoretical parallel universe, he is the Tsar of Russia. And, you know, in some kind of like alternate history novel, we'll depose Putin and we'll restore him to the throne in St. Petersburg. You know, but it has no, but Bizman Hazeh, for the last 100 years, is completely impractical. It's completely meaningless. But maybe to him it means a lot. Maybe to him and his family, they spend a certain amount of time focused on their heritage or on their yichus or on their, you know, what it means to be a descendant of the last Romanovs. It's not a perfect parallel, but I think you understand what it means. Something that has meaning, but no practical meaning. Halakha, the actual deed between law and life. He goes his own way and does not kick against his lot and fate. And then there's this final paragraph where he makes reference to mathematics and physics. And he, pardon me one second.
Ralph, your sound is off.
Hello? Hello? Can you hear me? Okay. The Rav makes these two parallel comparisons to geometry and physics. And I sent two links today. One is just a YouTube video that describes the difference between Euclidean and non-Euclidean space, Euclidean and non-Euclidean geometry. Euclid was, of course, a Greek. I mean, he lived in Alexandria around the year 300 BCE, 340, father of, you know, considered the father of geometry. And anybody who remembers anything at all from high school geometry, most of what we studied was Euclidean geometry, the system of geometry that Euclid lays out. Things like if you have two points, only one line can actually traverse between those two points, the laws of parallel lines, that two parallel lines will go on infinitely without ever bisecting, right angles, that if you have another line that intersects at a right angle, all four corners will be and will always remain right angles. This is Euclidean geometry, and of course it's true, except for the fact that it's true in theory. It's true when describing geometry on on paper in two dimensions. If anybody ever read the book Flatlands, you'll remember how this plays out in a kind of rather whimsical novelistic fashion. Riemann, who was a 19th century German mathematician, and Lobachevsky, who was a 19th century Russian mathematician, so they were the pioneers in non-Euclidean geometry, non-Euclidean space. As I said, when you actually superimpose these ideas in the three-dimensional universe onto a sphere, let's say, so things begin to look a little different. And the laws that Euclid laid out, which are true in the theoretical realm of thinking about space in the way that he did, do not always play out in the same way in spherical space. I can't pretend to be an expert on this any more than what I've already described, but it's a description of the degree to which a kind of theoretical system of theorems describe perfectly the world in which we live. The fact that now we understand that non-Euclidean geometry perfects it, has a richer explanation or a richer description, or disproves some of the theorems of Euclid, do not prevent us from living as if we still lived in Euclid's world. Or another example, we now know that we live on a sphere that's spinning at great speed, 365 and a quarter rotations a year, moving around a sun which is at the center of our galaxy. But throughout much of recorded history, that was not the conventional wisdom. Throughout much of recorded history, the belief was that the Earth was flat and stationary, and even those that understood it to be a sphere thought that it was stationary, and that the heavens were moving around the Earth. The fact that we now, post-Galileo, post-Copernicus, know the mechanics of the galaxy, of the solar system, rather, that doesn't prevent us from every day walking around on what appears to be a flat pancake, a flat, motionless pancake. We still experience the world on a daily basis the way that humanity always did, despite the fact that we know that that is not an accurate depiction of how it really is. And then he gives us these other examples from physics, etc. And this is, I mean, this final paragraph is almost parenthetical, and it is one of the ways that the world, I think, felt it important to bring in examples from and demonstrations from the sciences, which happened to have been a particular interest of his, but I think that he also had an understanding that it added weight and dignity and expression to what he was trying to articulate about the halakha. That the halakha is a system with no less rigor and integrity than mathematics or physics or science. And in that way, halakhic man is in many ways closer to cognitive man than homo religiosus, closer to the scientist than to the conventional saint. Although obviously in other ways it's the exact opposite, both being men of faith, cognitive man and halakhic man are one. But from the intellectual perspective, the halakha is a system no less rigorous. It's different. It operates under its own rules. But the rules of the halakha are no less defined, rigorous, or lacking in integrity than physics, mathematics, the sciences, etc. So now we've concluded this section dealing with how halakhic man interprets reality. And we will continue on next time.